He is immortalized for Americans by one phrase. Unfortunately, that phrase occurs in a speech whose only printed version first appeared 40 years after the event. He is the subject of Peter Rothermel's greatest painting out of all the great history paintings Rothermel created. Although, again, the painting was finished 70 years after the event it depicts. He was a man of the most devout personal Christianity. Yet he took the lead in stripping the largest church in his state of its tax revenues. His name, if you haven't guessed already, was Patrick Henry. And he is, above all of the other founders, the most self-contradictory, the most contrarian, and, sadly, one of the most consistent losers. Henry was also a comparatively new arrival on the American scene. His father, an Aberdeenshire Scot named John Henry, arrived in Virginia in 1727 with little more in hand than a letter of introduction to his half-brother, John Syme, a minor landowner in the Virginia Piedmont. When Syme died 4 years later, John Henry married Syme's widow, and Patrick, their second son, was born on May 29, 1736. This put John Henry in possession of over 7,000 acres and access to an ever-escalating series of civil offices, vestry of his local Church of England parish, chief justice of the county court, colonel of the county militia. That estate of his was still small holdings compared to the great Tidewater planters. I mean, Patrick Henry's childhood home was really just a 40 by 30 foot plain two-story clapboard house. But it was enough to give the Henry family enough leisure that the young Patrick Henry could spend his time with fishing rods and shotguns, disorderly in dress, slouching, unambitious, a roamer in the woods, a loiterer on riverbanks, having more tastes in common with trappers and frontiersmen, and with no hint or token of the possession of any intellectual gift. That is, until he encountered the formidable Reverend Samuel Davies. Samuel Davies arrived in Hanover County in 1747 and brought with him an entire alternate universe to the one Patrick Henry had thus far enjoyed. It was especially an alternate universe to the one that we have spent so much time with so far, and that is the 18th century Enlightenment. The universe of the Enlightenment loved reason, because reason, untrammeled by authority, was understood to have the power to peer into the mysteries of human life, discern their true and natural pattern, and then present them whole and complete to reshape the world in true and natural patterns. But lives lived strictly according to reason had these two great defects. First, they became stale, chilly, and unexciting. Second, no single human reason was capable of comprehending, sorting, and retaining all the data that the world threw at it. Every mystery that reason solved opened up two more. And reason fell very far short of offering an ultimate answer to the most fundamental question of all. How did everything come into being in the first place? Blaise Pascal, the French Catholic and mathematical genius, put his finger squarely on reason's limitations when he wrote that reason's last step is the recognition that there are an infinite number of things which are beyond it. It is merely feeble if it does not go as far as to realize that. What strength does reason actually have? Pascal asked. Everyone knows that the sight of cats or rats, the crunching of a coal, etc., is enough to unhinge reason. Anyone who chose to follow reason alone would have proved himself a fool. Of course, Pascal was himself too much a man of the Enlightenment to spit on reason entirely. But We know the truth not only through our reason, but also through our heart, by intuition, rather than by pure abstract thinking. It is through the heart, Pascal said, that we know first principles like space, time, motion, number, and ultimately, God. It is the heart, Pascal said, which perceives God and not the reason. That is what faith is. God perceived by the heart, not by reason. Pascal was only one of several starting points of a vast religious reaction to the Enlightenment, which we can call the Counter-Enlightenment, and which embraced in Europe Christian movements as diverse as French Jansenists, German Moravians, and English non-jurors and Methodists. But diverse though they were, they all had in common a profound conviction that reason told you only so much about life, and that religion and the heart had to be an important or even controlling aspect of human personality and society. In some respects, the preachers of counter-Enlightenment Christianity remained very much in the spirit of the Enlightenment because they too sought to throw off the restraints of authority and find in experience the genuine springs of religious life. And some of them turned out to be quite formidable reasoners on their own. But the religion of the heart remained the central guide of their lives. And no one expressed it better than the Englishman John Wesley, describing his own conversion to the religion of the heart on May 24, 1738, in these words. In the evening, I went very unwillingly to a society in Aldersgate Street in London, where one was reading Martin Luther's preface to the Epistle to the Romans, about a quarter before nine, while he was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone for salvation, and an assurance was given me that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death. It took less than a year for the evangelical experience Wesley described to make its transit to the British colonies of North America. And it did so most spectacularly through the agency of Wesley's colleague, George Whitefield. Whitefield was one of the greatest preaching talents of the 18th century. The most famous Shakespearean of the times, David Garrick, said that, "I would give 100 guineas if I could only say, oh, like Mr. Whitefield." Like Wesley, Whitefield was born in and ordained in the established Church of England. Like Wesley, Whitefield's preaching of the strangely warmed heart often made him persona non grata among the more sedate neighborhoods of the Church of England. And his solution was to strike out on his own. In 1739, Whitefield proposed founding an orphanage in the new British North American colony of Georgia. And to fund the orphanage, Whitefield embarked on a fundraising campaign through the colonies, which featured himself as the principal attraction. The movement he sparked, which became known simply as the Great Awakening, combined, in the words of Richard Bushman, all the fury of the civil rights demonstrations, the campus disturbances, and the urban riots of the 1960s combined. At the Presbyterian Church at Fags Manor, Pennsylvania, one observer described Whitefield's impact on his hearers in these words, "Look where I would, most were drowned in tears. The word was sharper than a two-edged sword. Their bitter cries and tears were enough to pierce the hardest heart. Oh, what different visages were then to be seen! Some were struck pale as death, others lying on the ground, others wringing their hands, others sinking into the arms of their friends, and most lifting up their eyes to heaven and crying out to God for mercy. I could think of nothing when I looked at them so much as the great day. They seemed like persons awakened by the last trump and coming out of their graves to judgment." One of the pupils, being trained for the ministry in a school operated by the Fags Manor Church, was Samuel Davies. Davies arrived in Virginia in 1747 on what was supposed to be a missionary tour of the scattered Presbyterian congregations of the Piedmont. But the people, however, received him as an angel of God and urged their request that he stay with them with such earnestness and zeal that he was prevailed on to settle among them. What Davies was doing, though, was, strictly speaking, illegal. The Church of England was the established religious denomination of the colony, not Presbyterians. Virginia's geography was divided religiously into parishes, the same way it was divided politically into counties. And Church of England parsons were appointed to the pastorates of those parishes in just the same way they were appointed in England, by the authority of the bishop. Now, since there was no Church of England bishop in the colonies, a commissary was appointed in Williamsburg to represent the Bishop of London, who had technical oversight of the American colonies. Above all, Virginians were taxed for the support of those appointees, whether they considered themselves churchgoers or not. And non-Church of England preachers and congregations could be fined even for appearing, much less gathering. Whether it was worth chasing down every dissenter and fining every dissenting congregation was another matter. And the House of Burgesses calmly decided to look the other way and issue licenses to non-Church of England clergy who would pledge conformity to the Church of England's 39 Articles of Religion and not make a nuisance of themselves. But Davies made a very successful nuisance of himself. By 1752, the commissary in Williamsburg, William Dawson, complained to the Bishop of London that until Davies arrived, people quietly conformed to the doctrine and discipline of our church. But now, there has been a great defection from our religious assemblies. But Davies proved to be as savvy politically as he was religiously, and a direct appeal to the Governor's Council in Williamsburg, and then the King's Attorney General in England, put the affair at rest. Patrick Henry thought that Davies was the greatest orator he ever heard, and a Tidewater merchant snarled that Henry had become so infatuated with Davies that he goes about, I am told, praying and preaching amongst the common people, even though Henry remained technically a member of the established church. The religion of the heart gave him a character which I prize far above all this world has or can boast. But the religion of the heart made little impression on Patrick Henry's father, who was determined to put some commercial stiffening into his wayward son by apprenticing him to a merchant of the county in order that he might be trained for the mercantile life. He didn't prosper. But he did meet Thomas Jefferson. While Jefferson was spending his Christmas holidays from William and Mary in 1759 at the Hanover County plantation of Nathaniel Dandridge. And it was at Jefferson's suggestion that Henry began reading law. He could have devoted little more than 6 weeks before showing up in Williamsburg to request a law license, which the colony's 4 law examiners seem to have granted with understandable reluctance. But Henry soon proved them wrong, or right, depending on the point of view. For one thing, Henry adapted the oratorical brilliance of the Awakeners to the practice of Virginia law. And between 1760 and 1763, he was attorney of record in 1,185 cases in Hanover and the neighboring counties. In an age when law was a genteel side pursuit of the great landowners, Henry took law as his life. Even more, he took to the drama of courtroom trials. Jefferson once remarked, indulgently, that Henry was too lazy for the acquisition or practice of bookish law. A later Virginia governor once imitated Henry's Piedmont drawl in a comment he once heard Henry utter. "Natural parts is better than all the larnin' upon yearth." But natural parts Henry had in abundance. And in December 1763, Henry was hired to serve as defense lawyer for the parish vestry of Fredericksville in Louisa County, in a case involving the so-called Two-Penny Act of 1758. The Two-Penny Act stipulated that Church of England clergy in Virginia were to be paid in paper money rather than in tobacco, which had been done since 1696, since tobacco was more valuable than the colony's scrip. The Reverend James Maury sued to recover the real value he thought he had been deprived of, and appealed to the King's Privy Council, which supported Maury. He was like the Tory in George Crabbe's 18th century poem, who was a churchman, 'twas his pride and boast, loyal his heart, and church and king his toast. He for religion might not warmly feel, but for the church he had abounding zeal. But Henry defended the Two-Penny Act on the grounds that neither the king nor the Privy Council had the authority to annul laws duly and properly passed by a legislature of the people of Virginia. The Two-Penny Act, he said, had every characteristic of a good law, that it was a law of general utility, and could not be annulled consistently with the compact between the king and the people, and that by this conduct the king, from being the father of his people, had degenerated into a tyrant and forfeited all right to his subjects' obedience to his order regarding it. Whew, this was an extraordinary raising of the stakes in what was otherwise a simple civil suit. But Henry was accustomed to seeing big consequences in small decisions. And spellbound by his eloquence, the excited people seized their champion and bore him on their shoulders in triumph around the courtyard. A year and a half later, they elected him to the House of Burgesses. The other thing which the Awakeners imparted to Patrick Henry was a suspicion of authority, whether the authority of the Church of England in Virginia or more distant versions. And that suspicion blossomed in the 1760s as Parliament began reaching ever deeper into the colonies to control and regulate the colonial economy for Britain's benefit. In May 1765, the House of Burgesses adopted a series of resolutions that Henry had composed on a blank leaf of an old law book, protesting the Stamp Act. And Henry strode to the floor in their defense with a blistering eloquence that Thomas Jefferson said was like hearing some speak as Homer wrote. The Stamp Act, Henry declared, was tyranny. And tyranny would meet with only one end. Tarquin and Caesar each had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III, and at this moment, the horrified Speaker of the House, John Robinson, interrupted with, "Treason! Treason!" And so Henry finished with a final jab which fell only a little short of treason. "May profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it." But he bettered that in 1774. When he called on the House of Burgesses to begin arming Virginians for resistance to the crown. "There is no retreat, but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable, and let it come. I repeat it, sir, let it come. Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. Why stand we here idle?" And then in words he borrowed from Joseph Addison's famous play, Cato, a Tragedy of 1713, Henry asked, "Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take. But as for me, give me liberty or give me death. The shade of Samuel Davies, who had been in his grave for 13 years by that time, could only have smiled. But the man whom Silas Deane of Connecticut called the Demosthenes of America, after the greatest of classical Greek orators, did not prove terribly successful beyond oratory. He was elected governor of Virginia on a wave of popularity in 1776, but he was chronically unable to work in harness with the state assembly, or even with Thomas Jefferson. He made one man, George Washington, eternally grateful for backing Washington resolutely in 1777 when Thomas Mifflin tried to unseat Washington from command. But otherwise, Henry's accomplishments as governor of Virginia were few and unremarkable, something for which Henry unhesitatingly blamed on his fellow Virginians' lack of virtue. "Public spirit seems to have taken its flight from Virginia," he groused to Richard Henry Lee in 1778. "The quota of our troops is not half made up, and no chance seems to remain for completing it. Let not Congress rely on Virginia for soldiers." This did not mean that he was any more enamored of the Confederation Congress, though. When he left office, he declined election to the Congress, and to the surprise of George Mason, used his seat in the Virginia Assembly to begin promoting a variety of debt relief measures, including the delaying of tax payments, prohibiting British merchants from doing business in Virginia, and permitting Virginia debtors to pay off pre-war debts to those merchants in depreciated Virginia paper money. An attempt to impose new taxes, Massachusetts style, was met by Henry's argument that this was a premature attempt, that policy required that the people should have some repose after the fatigues and privations to which they had been subjected during a long and arduous struggle for independence. George Mason, however, was not amused. He sternly reminded Henry in 1783 that the Revolution had not been waged to avoid our just debts or cheat our creditors, but to rescue our country from the oppression and tyranny of the British government, and to secure the rights and liberty of ourselves and our posterity. Neither was James Madison amused. Madison, who struggled to water down the debt payment scheme with amendments and resolutions. Well, Henry certainly shared none of Mason's hopes that joint action by the states through Congress could accomplish anything. The Confederation Congress's willingness to dally with the Spanish over a Mississippi River navigation appeared to Henry as an abandonment of Virginia's rights. "Congress are about to agree to give up the navigation of the Mississippi," he wrote indignantly to his sister. "A firm protest against the treaty whereby it is to be given up is, I think, necessary from your people." In fact, wrote an apprehensive fellow Virginian, John Marshall, "Mr. Henry, whose opinions have their usual influence, has been heard to say that he would rather part with the Confederation than relinquish the navigation of the Mississippi." But he infinitely preferred the Confederation to anything which gave a stronger grasp over the states to Congress. "The Confederation, this same despised government, merits, in my opinion, the highest encomium," Henry declared. "It carried us through a long and dangerous war. It rendered us victorious in that bloody conflict with a powerful nation. It has secured us a territory greater than any European monarch possesses. And shall government which has been thus strong and vigorous be accused of imbecility and abandoned for want of energy?" But Henry did not prefer the Confederation because he loved it. He preferred it because he was convinced that its very weakness was a guarantee to the states of liberty. "I am fearful," Henry said, "I have lived long enough to become an old-fashioned fellow. Perhaps an invincible attachment to the dearest rights of man may, in these refined, enlightened days, be deemed old-fashioned. If so, I am contented to be so. I say the time has been when every pulse of my heart beat for American liberty, and which, I believe, had a counterpart in the breast of every true American. Liberty, the greatest of all earthly blessings. Give us that precious jewel, and you may take everything else. Oddly, however, Henry believed that the one mechanism for restoring virtue to Virginia and preserving liberty to America was in public funding for religion. Not a state-established church like the Church of England had been, but support for teachers of the Christian religion regardless of denomination. In 1784, he sponsored a bill in the Virginia Assembly arguing that the general diffusion of Christian knowledge hath a natural tendency to correct the morals of men, restrain their vices, and preserve the peace of society. Since this cannot be effected without a competent provision for learned teachers, Henry proposed a general assessment on Virginia taxpayers, which would support the teachers of any denomination. Christianity, and no mention was made of any non-Christian teachers, would thus be promoted, but without counteracting the liberal principle heretofore adopted and intended to be preserved by abolishing all distinctions of preeminence amongst the different societies or communities of Christians. Henry's bill left the jaws of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson hanging open. The whole project was, as Madison wrote to Jefferson, extraordinary, and would probably have expired quietly in committee had it not been preserved from a dishonorable death by the talents of Mr. Henry. But not even Henry's fabled eloquence was a match for Madison's relentless logic, or for his sharp hand at political maneuvering in the Assembly. When the bill came up for debate in December of 1784, Madison skewered it by asking a series of embarrassing questions. The bill was to provide for teachers of any Christian denomination? Did that include famous heresies like Arianism, Socinianism? Is it salvation by faith or works also, by free grace or free will? Any non-Christian or quasi-Christian teachers who found themselves disqualified would surely take the matter into the courts. In that case, what clue is to guide a judge through this labyrinth? What is orthodoxy? What heresy? And how is a court to determine its answer when the question comes before them whether any particular society is a Christian society? Madison then countered Henry's general assessment bill with a memorial and remonstrance in June 1785, which laid out Madison's skepticism that any connection between church and state was either healthy or viable. The religion of every man must be left to the conviction and conscience of every man. Even a general assessment, which can establish Christianity in exclusion of all other religions, will sooner or later become a force for establishing, with the same ease, any particular sect of Christians in exclusion of all other sects. In effect, Madison was turning the logic, which had protected awakeners like Samuel Davies, into a reason for undercutting state-decreed protections for anyone, including awakeners. And the bill died in committee after all. But Madison knew that it was unwise to discount Henry's power over Virginians' minds. And that was a special sort of anxiety for Madison after the Annapolis meeting had recommended a national convention for Philadelphia in May of 1787. The part which Mr. Henry will take is unknown here. Much will depend on it. Madison's warnings were not diminished when Henry ostentatiously declined an invitation from Virginia Governor Edmund Randolph to attend the Philadelphia meeting. Mr. Henry is the great adversary who will render the event precarious, Madison predicted. And he was right.